everybody. Get ready for Foodie and the Beast with David and Nikki Nellis. A foodie born and bred, my wife Nikki loves chatting up chefs, dining out, and insider industry buzz.
And my husband David thinks a great meal is nothing but a good burger, a frosty brew, and a check for under $20. Because he is cheap.
Well, maybe so, but Foodie married Beast anyway, and together we've got the food and wine variety show that has everyone talking.
It's Foodie and the Beast, and we are on now.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Foodie and the Beast. David and Nikki Nellis on this beautiful Sunday, the very last Sunday of Donald Trump's moments in the White House. We've been celebrating all week, all night. So we're delighted that he's gone. Quarantining still sucks, but there's all this great food and drink happening around the area, and we'll be telling you all about it today and from home until we can get back into the studio and on the air. Nick, you want to catch everybody up on what's happening on the restaurant scene there real quick?
Yeah, so it was a really busy week, and I really beg people, if you are able to order from restaurants, etc., now is the time to do it. That riot last week had to shut a lot of restaurants down, and of course what's going on with the inauguration, it's really pulling much needed cash from these restaurants at a time when they obviously really need it. So go to the list or you want it.com. Believe it or not, there are so many restaurants and bars that are doing to-go packages for inauguration, lots of celebration boxes. So lots of ways to participate in the celebration and also support your restaurant. So we have the whole list on the list or you want it.com. Aside from the inauguration, there are a ton of food and wine demos happening all around the city. You should really now take a look at the calendar for the week and find out what you're doing. Lastly, mark your calendar for Tuesday, January 26th. It's International Sous Vide Day, and it's totally virtual. Everybody can participate. Chefs from all around the world are doing cooking demos and panels. I just hosted a panel with Daniel Boulud and Grace Ramirez and Kyle Connaughton. It was fabulous. So all these great things are going to be happening on that day. Please mark your calendar. And David, why don't you introduce the guests who are going to be on the show today?
I will, as I eat my sous vide eggs from Starbucks, which I
okay, good.
All right. So joining us, as always, is Deb Moser of Central Farm Markets. We're going to be talking about some of the things you would not expect to find at a farmer's market that you can find at Central Farm Markets. Julie Peterson of Mark Wine Group is going to be on talking about the wines of Georgia. Georgia and Bulgaria argue all the time about who invented wine. Julie's going to tell us that it was Georgia, and we'll find out more. Everybody knows that true Neapolitan pizza is something special for your taste buds. Pizzeria Pupatella brings the real deal here. Neapolitan pizza baked in a real pizza oven made in Naples. To us, Michael Berger is one of the partners of Pizzeria Pupatella, and he's going to be on telling us all about it. Yael Krigman is a genius baker. We have had her bagels, and she bakes that and more. Baked by Yael is in Woodley Park across from the zoo, and we're going to be talking to her about she had an odd journey to become a baker. And speaking of pizza, again, Jordan Feinberg loves it so much. He went to Italy in search of the greatest pizza. It could be baked, sold frozen, and baked again at home. And he says he's found it. It's called Pinsa, and we're going to hear about it.
It's Pinsa. It's not pizza. It's not pizza. It's Pinsa.
Well, but it's okay. You know, we'll get the guy on the phone. He says it's pizza.
Okay, so you know,
called Pinsa.
You're wrong.
Just so you know. Okay. You don't know anything. Sure. And let's talk to Deb Moser. Deb, so yes. Central Farm Markets has fresh produce and meats and all of that, but you guys... it's unusual for farmers markets have spirits and beers and all of that. Talk
okay,
a little bit
well,
about that.
That's not the question. I want to back up.
That's my question.
Here's the thing. When people think of a farmer's market, they think of, just like David said, eggs and meats, maybe, I mean, even fish seems a little out of the way for it, but veggies, right? Like that's where, and plants,
right.
Like things that come out of the ground. But now when you go to a farmer's market, there's so many other things happening, and wine, beer, and spirits appear there now. How did that happen? Where did that change come?
That's a good question. And I will tell you, in the state of Maryland, Mitch actually had a hand in making that happen. Originally, the wineries were not allowed to come to a farmer's market. Yet here they are, agricultural enterprises, and they were not deemed ready to come to the markets or fit to come to the markets, however the state looked at them. So Mitch got together with some of our state representatives, and they went to the state and they said they are agricultural enterprises. They should be allowed to come. And they actually got a bill signed. And in the beginning, they were allowed to come, I think, once a month. Well, it became so popular that the state granted licenses to do more than just once a month. So we now have, that was extended out from wineries into breweries and distilleries. And you know, each state has a myriad of wonderful wineries, breweries, and distilleries, and they're all locally grown and managed. And so we rotate them through the markets. So each week you'll know, you get a note on our e-blast who's going to be there. And some of our favorites are Miscellaneous Distillery. They have some wonderful whiskeys, and their gin is outstanding. We have Twin Valley Distillers, and they're local right here in Rockville. Some of these people are even distributing now through the liquor stores and the wine shops. Butterfly Spirits, their vodkas are to die for.
And their packaging
is crazy.
Oh, their packaging is gorgeous, just gorgeous. And Wardaka.
Can we say,
Brewery,
just by the way, that the founder of that company is a brain surgeon?
All right. Quick story. I taught him in high school. I taught him everything.
And you know what?
Knows.
He told us he had the hots for one of his high school teachers. So maybe
it wasn't me.
Going on there. You could have had
He's
a brain surgeon.
He's a great guy. Yeah. He's a great guy. So I know where to go for my vodka and brain surgery.
And brain surgery, right.
And
we have to wrap it up. So let's give a shout out to one more and then tell everybody where they can find you.
So Waradaka Brewery, they have horses. They have outdoor seating now. You got to find them. You can find us at centralfarmmarkets.com. We're open both in Virginia and Bethesda all winter. So come out and see us.
Great. Thanks, Deb.
All right. Let's talk to Julie Peterson about Georgian wines. You know, So when some people see wines of Georgia, do they get confused and think you're talking about Atlanta?
No. I don't think so anymore.
I hope not. So how did you get involved in this? Because it's a little unusual. Do you have is your family of Georgian descent?
You know, actually, I'm a farmer's daughter from Iowa. But I think what was so interesting when we work in the wine industry, and usually we work with countries or regions, and I had some friends go to Georgia actually on a tourism conference, and they came back and they were like, Julie, you have got to go to Georgia. There's something super exciting going on there. It's unbelievable. And I didn't, you know, I knew where Georgia was, but hadn't had any of the wines there. So at the time I went to Red Hen and met with some importers and tried some Georgian wine and had never tasted anything like it. So I flew to Georgia the next month and that was 5 years ago. Just, we were blown away by what is developing there.
Well, so let's talk about the wines of Georgia and, you know, for people who are unaware of the grapes and flavor profiles, what we're looking at.
Yeah, I think that the interesting thing, I mean, Georgia is kind of like Italy in that it has over 500 varietals. So there's kind of a lot to sift through. There's really about 10 that are really going strong right now in the US market. So they have a big red called Saporavi, which is sort of like a Cabernet, but it's not tannic in structure. Right. So, and it has higher acid. So it's just like a big red wine, but it's easy to drink because it doesn't have that high tannic structure. And then Rocatatelli is their largest white wine that's planted, white grape that's planted. And, you know, they make a lot of their wines they make their white wines like they make their red wines with the skins buried in the ground in these large clay pots. Mm-hmm. And so what emerges is this like golden wine that has like dried apricots, white tea. It's all these flavors that we're not really used to when we think about a white wine.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a bolder wine. Like it's, I don't know how to explain it. But it has way more body than say, you know, a California Sauvignon Blanc, right?
For sure. I mean, if you don't put the skins with it, it would be very much like kind of like a Chenin almost. But when you put the skins with it, it's just like putting the skins with a red wine. You get this, instead of getting a rosé, you get this like great, you know, just kind of a bolder, as you say, like it has legs to it. Yeah, and it has body.
So let me jump in with a question, because, you know, George, I mean, clearly during the times of the Soviet Union, Georgian wines were not going to be well known or even thought of by folks out here in the US or the free world. Now they're out, and after, you know, and Georgia is independent. What's holding, I mean, are you being held back still from kind of a branding point of view? Because if people hear it's an Italian wine, a French wine, or maybe now a Spanish wine, they're like, oh, or a Chilean wine. And a lot of that is just marketing. It's the nation putting money into that. Is the country of Georgia kind of helping you do your thing, or no?
Yeah, I mean, you had a lot of questions bundled there. You know, they've only been an open country. We've only had access to their wines they got their independence in 91.
Right.
Sort of like Ukraine was the breadbasket for all of the Soviet states. Georgia was the wine cask. So they're very, very famous in that part of the world. I mean, if you go to any country in the old Soviet blocs, if you ask anyone, they'll be like, where does the best wine come from? Across the board, everyone will say Georgia. So we just didn't know. We didn't have access to it. They're a young country. They got their independence in 91. 2008, the very first exports of Georgian wine went to Europe. I mean, that was not that long ago. Right. So we're still under discovery, you know, and I love the fact that they're planting their indigenous varieties. They're not trying to jump on board and try to, you know, plant more Cabernet Sauvignon or Chardonnay. They're like, well, these are the grapes that we've always grown. This is what we're going to continue to grow. So I think a big part of it is just like educating people to be like, try a Saporavi. You know, it's like in the same category as a Cabernet Sauvignon or a Malbec, or a Gamay, for example. So I think it's just people getting information about them. And I love this kind of openness of exploration right now that's in the wine market. So that's super exciting.
Okay, Julie, we're going to take a quick break. But when we come back, I really want to talk about, you know, there's an opening of new Georgian restaurants, Tabla and Supra and Compass Rose. So the public is learning about the cuisine, which goes hand in hand with the wine. So we'll get into that. This is David and Nikki Nellis, Foodie and the Beast. We'll get back in just a sec.
Okay, we're back on Foodie and the Beast with David and Nikki Nellis, and we are talking to Julie Peterson about wines of Georgia. We have had Georgian wines. I think the first time we tried them was probably 5 or 6 years ago, and the word that keeps coming, when you mentioned a Gamay, that's what I would think of it. It's rich and deep and delicious. There are no wimpy Georgian wines that I can remember ever tasting.
But Julie, there's not just like two wines, right? I mean, there's lots of styles of wine. So can you tell us a little bit about some of the wines? Like if I were to go to a wine store, where would you direct me for, you know, let's say two kinds of whites and two kinds of reds?
So typically Georgian wine, because it's new, it's typically in the European section. It's like other Europe. So if you go in, you're like, hey, I'd love to try some Georgian wine. Typically it's in the European section. And you will always see probably a Saporavi, which is, I think you're right. It is more like a Gamay because it doesn't have that like strong tannic structure. It doesn't feel like when you're drinking it, you know, you're getting punched in the face. It's like a Gamay. And so the other one, one of my favorites is called Alla d'Astori, which is more of like a Pinot Noir. It's a light, medium bodied wine, and the depth, the high acid of it. It's like it's grown up in the mountains. I mean, Georgia is almost an entirely mountainous country, but this Alla d'Astori is just a phenomenal grape. So if you can find Alla d'Astori as well, those are two that are really the reds that are available in the Washington area.
Okay.
And then the whites, the two that really stand out are Riccazzatelli and Mizvani. And both of them, Riccazzatelli, can be really big and bold. It can also, without the skin contact, again, it's super high acidic wine. And that's why I think the pairing and Nikki, as you say, with the in the category with the food, you know, these foods can stand up. If you go to into a Whole Foods market and you say, what works well with like Asian food? You know, the buyers at Whole Foods are like, okay, the Georgian wines is what they recommend every time because it has such an, it has the whites both have tannic structure and they can stand up to Asian food. They can stand up to heavy, like creamed foods, like all
well,
of these.
Well, I can think of cacciapore. I mean, that bready, cheesy, eggy dish. I mean, that's not light eating. I mean, that's, you know, you need a wine that can stand up with that.
You do. If your listeners haven't heard about cacciapore, it is the Georgian mountainous pizza. Okay. Essentially, it's like this big cheese boat. Which comes in like, there's 12 different styles depending on the region that you're in. And it's just, you do need, you know, you need some wine to go with that so that can stand up to that cheesy business.
Guys, let me jump in. Unfortunately, Julie, we're running out of time, but I want to make sure that you tell our listeners where they can find, number one, where they can find Georgian wines around the DC area. Number two, since there are no wine tastings these days, how they can learn more about this, you know, where do they go to find out more and at least get a sense of what's waiting for them when this quarantining ends?
Yeah. Well, you know, there's the two big Georgian restaurants and of course, Compass Rose. The first time I tasted Georgian wine though was in, was Red Hen, which still carries it, Primrose, Tailup Goat. I mean, all these guys who are sort of introducing the market in the DC area to new regions and regions that we may not be aware of. I mean, Georgian wine is in all of those and in the independent retailers as well, from, well, Whole Foods, but then, you know, Domestique, anyone that specializes in natural wine. Georgian wine is kind of the leader in natural wine. So anybody who's specializing in Georgian wine to Potomac, you know, down on M Street. So it's really, this is an exciting city to be in because there's so much Georgian wine in the marketplace for you to find.
All right, Julie, thank you so much for joining us today. It's always a pleasure to have you on and talk about Georgian wine.
Thank you. Have a great day.
All right. So up next, we're going to talk about Pupatella Pizzeria, which I had Pupatella my first time, like 15 years ago. It was a little place in Virginia. I went with a couple of food writers and it was like the pizzeria darling at the time. And now it's expanded and it's so exciting.
Michael Berger is one of the partners. He's up. Michael, we got you on the phone?
Yes, sir.
Good.
Good morning.
For those who aren't aware of the Pupatella brand, can you tell us a little bit about its background and like its origins?
So Pupatella is, first and foremost, I think the name kind of leads it off, is Pupatella. This is Enzo, so my business partner Enzo Algarme and his wife Anastasia. They are the founders of the brand. And Pupatella is a word in really only in Naples that is spoken, and it means little doll. And that was his grandmother's nickname. And so the restaurant is after his grandmother's namesake. Enzo is from Naples, born and raised in Naples. He ended up coming over to the DC area to go to school at George Mason University and play soccer there. He was actually almost, I wouldn't say kicked out, but strongly encouraged by his family to leave Naples because his family had been in food for years and years and years in that specific region. And they wanted somebody to kind of branch out. So Enzo tried his hand at soccer here at George Mason, had a pre-medical degree that he got, was working in the medical field between potentially going to medical school, realized that there was just no pizza like he had known at home. And it kind of frustrated him. And so he and Anastasia decided to start a food cart outside the Ballston Metro, making pizza exactly as you would find in Naples. And so, you know, we go to great lengths to prepare pizzas exactly as you would find in Naples today or 150 years ago. So we're not Neapolitan style. We're not Neapolitan like. We're not Neapolitan imitators. We are Neapolitan.
Well,
and that's really the ethos of the brand.
But Michael, one of the keys to Neapolitan pizza is the Neapolitan, the real deal Neapolitan pizza oven.
Yes, sir.
And so, I mean, talk a little bit about that, because I think, you know, I used to work in a pizzeria when I was in college, and we had ovens that went up to 600 degrees, and we'd slam the pizza in there, pull it out, and serve it.
There's, I know, but that was an Italian style pizza.
I'm saying there's way more to it than that. Why? What makes the ovens, the Neapolitan ovens, more special?
Absolutely. So 600 degrees is quite low. That would actually be like what our oven would be sitting at a couple of hours after we've actually fully emptied out all the embers. So our ovens will get up to anywhere between 800 and 1,000 degrees throughout the day, obviously depending on how much wood is fed into it. We're an entirely wood-burning oven. So there is no utility service to it. It is a brick oven made out of ash from Mount Vesuvius. And yes, the Mount Vesuvius that wiped out Pompeii way, way back when. That is one of the trademarks of true Neapolitan ovens, is to be made out of this compressed brick. Compressed ash from Mount Vesuvius. And then it's tiled over. It has an incredible heat retention. And I said that kind of jokingly, but for a long while, and Nikki, you may remember this, the restaurant in North Arlington was closed on Mondays. We've since opened on Mondays. But Enzo, at one point, a few years back, actually showed me, and I couldn't even believe it. On Monday morning, Anastasia goes in and she makes gelato on Monday morning. We make our own fresh gelato. And the oven is still hot enough after having sat from the night before and getting in there at, you know, 9:10 in the morning, you could still cook a pizza in it. Takes a little longer. Normally our pizzas, when it's up in the 800 to 1,000 degree range, will take anywhere between 60 and 90 seconds to cook. So it's very fast. And the pizziolo and those on the oven are very good at their trade. You can very quickly burn these pizzas if you're not paying close attention, if you're not rotating it. So there really is an art form to it. And you're exactly right. The oven is the engine that drives it all. And we're importing those from Naples for each of our restaurants. They're built there. They're tiled here in the United States and then shipped to us.
Well, talk a little bit about the pizzaiolo, too, because you need a special certificate of training to be a certified pizza maker in Naples. What kind of training is that? I mean,
yes. So you're right. Enzo, when he decided that he wanted to open his own location to make pizza and really become a true pizziolo, he went back and trained under some of the finest pizziolos in the Naples area. Obviously, he had grown up around it as well and had done his own cooking, but he went and really got the training there in the region. We maintain a VPN certification, which is an Italian government designation. It started out actually as some of the oldest pizza making families in Naples. I don't want to say in the 80s, they decided everyone was trying to imitate Naples pizza, Neapolitan pizza. And so they decided they wanted to start an association.
Right.
And that association then offered certifications to those that were doing it in the old Neapolitan style. And I'm sure you guys know this, some of your listeners may not, but, you know, Naples is credited with where pizza was invented. So it was really important to them that they maintained their craft. They maintained the ingredients. They maintained the oven style that they were knowing that that's how their pizzas were made. And so each of our restaurant locations gets a VPN certification. And what that entails is our pizziolos from, you know, even before we open each of these restaurant locations, they come in and they train under some of our certified, under our certified restaurant with our pizziolos that have been making it for years and years. And then they go off and then the VPN team comes and they certify the restaurant, and they're looking for not just the processes by which you're making things. They look at the equipment. So we have to use a certain kind of mixer. We need to use a certain kind of oven. We need to use a certain kind of flour. We need to make our dough with only the ingredients of water, yeast, salt, and 00 flour. We need
getting
to use,
hungry.
Hey, Michael,
yeah.
Patrick.
So, yep.
we have to take a quick break. So I'm just going to put you on hold for a second. We'll have about 2 minutes when we come back, okay? This is David and Nikki Mellon with Foodie and a Beast. We're talking about Pupitella Pizza, which is now in multiple locations. We'll find out more about that when we come back.
We are back on Foodie and the Beast with David and Nikki Nellis. We're talking to Michael Berger, who's one of the partners at Pupitella. Is it Pizzeria Pupitella or Pupitella Pizzeria, Michael?
Pupitella. And then, Pupitella right. Pizzeria.
And you started with one little location out in Virginia, and now you're today, Virginia, tomorrow, the world. Tell us where to find you and how to order these pizzas.
Well, thank you. Yes. So we have five locations now. We have our original location in North Arlington. We opened a location in Richmond, Virginia, in the Fan District, which is in their downtown area, a few years ago. Last December, we opened in South Arlington, kind of call it a sister restaurant to our North Arlington location. And that is at the intersection of South Walter Reed and Glebe Road, just up from Shirlington. We then recently this summer opened a location in DuPont Circle, in the space that was formerly Rosemary Time or right next door to Anjou. And we then most recently over the holidays, actually, which is where I spent a lot of my time over the holidays, we opened a new location in Reston, Virginia.
What is something wrong with Maryland, Michael?
Not at all.
Anti-Marylander, right?
No, I'm a local. I grew up in this area. And even from local knows that the DMV really does function as kind of a tri area. So no, we are working actively at the moment on some sites in Maryland. Okay. Nothing that I can quite announce yet, but yes, that is in the works.
All right, I feel better.
So we have 1 minute left, Michael. Just if you could just tell everybody sort of, you know, how to get access. I mean, clearly in DC, there's no indoor dining. Do you guys have patios? Mm-hmm. What's the best? Do you use third party? Do you prefer people to order directly through you? What's the best way to get access to your products?
Absolutely. So for all the locations, you can do a walk-up order. We have it set up where we have safe spaces, we have plexiglass, we have social distancing, so we can take in-person orders. At the locations right now, we're really not doing indoor dining, so it is all takeaway. We've just made that decision recently to kind of keep it out of the restaurant. And then we do have online ordering. So if you go to our website, pupitella.com, all of the restaurant locations will have a page where you can link to their online menu and you can order online there. And we do have patios. Our North Arlington location kind of has a beautiful, we actually recently expanded it just before quarantine, actually. We had expanded this back area into kind of a beer garden layout. So we have a lot of outdoor spaces there, a lot of social distancing. Our DuPont Circle location has a large patio there on the corner, and we have heaters at both North Arlington and we have heaters in DuPont. And then in South Arlington, we have a covered patio. We're in the process of installing some side panels, not fully enclose it because obviously that would make it almost like being inside, but to at least cut the wind. And then in Reston, we have a large patio space where we have several tables outside, a few of which have fire pits in the center, and then we have some heaters scattered around. Nice. And anyone is welcome to dine with us.
I gotta cut you off, dude. Sorry. I mean, everything you're saying is really interesting, but we only have so much time. So can you please just give your website?
www.pupitella.com.
Great. Thanks so much for joining us. Up next, we're going to be talking to a local bagel maker, but she started with Cake Pops. Yael, are you there?
Hi. Thanks for having me on your show.
Hi, Yael. How are you?
Before we get into Yael and what she does at Baked by Yael, a couple weeks ago, I dragged my son on Christmas morning to walk from my house in Kensington to the zoo so that we could pick up Yael's bagels for our own Jewish Christmas, which was so much fun. And she was there with her boyfriend. She gave her her crew the day off, but she and her boyfriend were there making bagels. It was so great. So I'm a fan. So Yael, it's so nice of you to join us today. Can you tell us a little bit, because you did not get into baking, like you didn't grow up and was like, I'm a baker. You practice law.
Yes, I never would have thought that this would be my career. I I went to law school. I practiced law for a couple of years. I was actually at a firm for 8 years and never dreamed.
And then you said, why am I killing myself this way? I'd rather kill myself making challah. So.
Exactly. Well, you know, I would bring in baked goods just for fun to my coworkers. And I realized at one point that there was one job I was doing because I really enjoyed it and made people happy. And there was another job I was doing for the money. And so I thought, well, maybe I can try to make money doing what I love. As it turns out, you can't, but you can certainly try and have fun while you're doing it.
But now when you started, it was cake pops, right? I mean, that's how I remember hearing about you first, but you were doing bagels too. Like, how did you morph into this business?
So I actually started because I had a friend of mine come to visit me and she loved bagels and I was trying to find a good bagel for us to enjoy. And I could not. I thought, you know what? Let's just make our own bagels. So we made bagels. And that's actually how I got my start, making bagels. And that's what I would bring into my classmates and to my coworkers. And then from there, it sort of became a stress reliever when I was studying for the bar. You know, you're not supposed to hang out with friends. You're not supposed to go out. You're not supposed to do anything but study. And that's not my personality. So I started baking as a form of procrastination and just started baking more things for more people and realized that I actually really enjoyed it.
And so how did you expand on that? When you opened up did you do a brick and mortar first or did you start delivery first? How did you get into it?
So I started because, you know, the lawyer in me, I figured, well, I may as well register my LLC. I may as well sign up to pay my taxes. I may as well just start my business, even if it's just going to be a side thing. And then my coworkers, they'd come in for a Monday treat, I called it. So they'd come into my office every Monday and they would say, oh, this is so amazing. You know, you're a great lawyer, but you should really consider opening up your own bakery.
It sounds like the way our dogs hang around the dinner table, hoping for something better than what they eat.
Well, that is not the comparison I would make, but fair enough.
Well, I mean, they're looking for, Vicky happens to be a great cook. I think they're looking for something better.
So one day from a day treat, I brought in cake pops. And I had just read about them in a book. I think I had seen something on a listserv about them, didn't even really know what they were. And my coworkers always loved my treats. But when I brought in cake pops, they just flipped out. And at that point, I had just started operating a kiosk at the Annapolis Mall. And I decided that that would be a great opportunity to try out the cake pops. So it all happened very quickly. I actually started selling cake pops a couple of weeks before Starbucks did. So in that sense, that's probably the only sense in which I've been trendy. Everything else has been very traditional.
I have a question, just a quick one. I have a cousin, Yael, in Israel, but you were born and bred in America, correct?
That's correct. My dad is Israeli.
So do people have trouble pronouncing your name? Do they call you Yale?
People have called me everything under the sun. So that has been, and I actually had a focus group with about 3 dozen people to decide what the name of my bakery should be. And I said it definitely should not have my name in it. And everybody else said it definitely should. So it has made it interesting for sure.
Well, so now let's get to now. So you have this brick and mortar. It's across from the zoo. We're in the middle of a pandemic. I mean, I assume you had a tremendous amount of sales coming from the zoo. I mean, you walk out of the entrance of your zoo and there are cake pops and baked goods. I mean, I imagine that was a huge portion of your sales. How did you pivot?
Transition.
Yeah, absolutely. The zoo has brought in a ton of sales. We also did a lot of corporate catering and events and offices. We worked with a lot of hotels. So the cake pops were really our bread and butter. And the bagels were always there because, to be honest, our hardcore customers would not let me stop selling bagels. They were so we kept them on. And I always thought, well, you know, it'll be good to have these traditional Jewish baked goods in case cake pops aren't trendy anymore. So I thought this was going to happen in several years and I would have something to fall back on. Well, of course, when the pandemic hit, nobody wants 100 cake pops in their house and they're not having any events. They're not having any parties.
But
well, sorry, that's true. I shouldn't judge. Some people might want 100 cake pops in their house, but not everybody. But what they did want was they wanted the bagels and the challah and the rugelach and the things that provided comfort to them in a more of an emotional way. You know, cake pops are fun and delicious. And I think what people really needed was something that it seemed so simple, but it brought so much joy to their home and to their lives during such a terrible year.
And so were you able, given, you know, sort of the amount of cake pops you were making, even though you still made bagels and challah, were you able to increase that production given your space? Was that a problem?
It was not a problem. It was a huge challenge because we were not set up to be a bagel bakery. Right. We were a cake poppery that also sold bagels. So we don't have registered trademark. we did not have the space for it. We did not have the ovens for it. Of course, social distancing has been a challenge. So we really just had to make it work. And we have, because I was so committed to keeping my staff. And I also felt a strong obligation to my customers. You know, they wanted these bagels and I wanted them to be happy. So we made it work. And we have managed to work our production out in a way that we can make the cake pops for people who are sending them all over the country. We can make the bagels for people who want them at home, and we can try to stay safe.
But you're also doing classes. You do demos, right?
Yes. So we used to have cake pop parties in the store, and they were so much fun. And there would be screaming children running around the kitchen. And we even had bachelorette parties and corporate cake pop classes. And of course, that all just came to a grinding halt in March. So again, you know, my goal is to stay in business. This is my livelihood. I felt obligated to my staff. So, you know, my boyfriend and I were just brainstorming, like, what can we do? Like, we can't just give up. And so he actually helped me create a Zoom studio in the kitchen. So now it's almost better because people can do it safely from home and they can do it all over the country. So people right. who otherwise would never have been able to come to do a class are now able to learn how to make cake pops, and we just ship them their cake pop kits. So it's a ton of fun.
Well, I always say it's the tiniest, itty bittiest of silver linings of the pandemic is this Zoom, right? Like being able to access people all over the world as opposed to just the people who can come into your store.
But I've got exactly. a very important question, Yael. Okay. So get ready.
Okay.
There are two groups of cake pop eaters. One that says you shove the whole thing into your mouth and slide it off and eat it that way. And the other that says you nibble. Now, what is the proper way to eat a cake pop?
I would have to say that the proper way is whichever way makes you the happiest.
Oh, that's a quibbling answer.
I have friends who will eat them in one bite, and I do not judge them. Yeah, I personally eat them in four bites because I like even numbers, and I like savoring things.
Yeah, we're going to have to wrap up. But before we do, are you doing cake pops for inauguration?
We are doing red, white, and blue cake pops for inauguration. Yes, yep. Absolutely.
Oh, have you been biding your time waiting to make them?
All right. Yael, tell everybody, please, where they can find you, your brick and mortar, and where they can find you online to order your fabulous bagels, cake pops, and challah.
Sure. Baked by Yael is across from the National Zoo. We're also at several farmers markets, and you can order online 24/7 at bakedbyyael.com.
Excellent. Thanks so much. Good to see you.
Thanks for having me.
Bye.
Okay,
bye.
Up next, we are going to learn about pinsa. It's not pizza, it's pinsa, with Jordan Feinberg.
So our next guest is a gentleman named Jordan Feinberg who went on a quest to find the perfect pizza that could be made, frozen, and then basically baked again and not get mushy. And he discovered pinsa. And Jordan joins us now. Hi, Jordan. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you.
I don't know if that was Jordan's quest. I think you just
he went on a quest to find the best pizza, right? that you could preserve and pass on. Tell us the story.
So, okay, no, it's not quite that, but we'll take that as an answer.
That sounds pretty sexy, though, don't you think? A quest.
Yeah. No, even sexier than that is I was online one evening looking at webcams. And I came across this live webcam inside of a pizzeria in Italy. And kind of being a food guy, I got obsessed with just watching what they were doing in the kitchen. And they were making these really cool kind of artistic style pizzas like I've never seen, like star shape that had ricotta cheese and fillings in the corners. And they take the pizza out of the oven and then they would spend 5 or 10 minutes dressing it up with burrata and all kinds of stuff. It was gorgeous, like putting a salad in the center of a ring. And I guess through the power of Facebook and the internet, I connected with them and, you know, told them I enjoyed watching them. And they said that they teach people, and why don't I come out to Tuscany and learn? I guess who wouldn't pass up a trip or an excuse for a trip, right? It was 2 years ago in November. So November's not quite the best month. But so I arrive in this little tiny town called Masa Maritima, which is on a hillside overlooking the sea. And
near Viareggio? Where is it near Viareggio?
It's near Grosseto. It's in the Grosseto province near Falonica. Anyway, so I started. And they don't speak English. I don't really speak Italian. So we arranged for a translator who happened to be my Airbnb host or my VRBO host, and started up with them for, you know, a week and a half. And, you know, the first bit, Marco, the owner of this pizzeria, said, you've got to learn about the dough. So, you know, okay. So we went to their commissary and we're making a lot of dough. That evening, we went back to the pizzeria. And he's, you know, we were going to have dinner, and like all restaurant guys, you order everything on the menu, right? But I was interested in all these cool shaped pizzas. And he said, through the translator, you've got to try this other thing, this pinza. And I'm like, okay, thick crust pizza never really excited me in life. But he said, you know, let's try it. And he actually said before it came out, he said, this will be what you eat the rest of your 2 weeks here. I said, okay. And sure enough, like one bite, it was unbelievable. It was thick, but it was like you're eating a down blanket. I mean, it was so fluffy and airy and crispy and like just a palate for what was on top of it. It was incredible. Anyway.
And so it's called pinza. Pizza. And so what was it that you were like, yeah, I'm going to bring this to the States? I mean, do you need special products? Like, what do you do to make that happen?
So pinza is incredibly difficult. Like, I left Italy and I could barely make it. But because it's a really complicated dough, it's normal pizza dough has about 50-55% water. Pinza has 85%. So it's super wet. Also, flour really doesn't want to absorb all that water. So you've got to mix it in a special way. The big secret though, and don't tell anybody, is that it's a 72 hour fermentation period.
Okay.
So the dough has to be incredibly strong to enable the yeast to eat all the sugar and turn it into amino and acid and do all its things. But part of that is that it can't get too warm while you're mixing the dough, because then it'll kind of make the yeast go too fast. So you've got like a lot of issues here. You've got a very wet dough. You've got to incorporate all that water into the dough, into the flour. And then you've got to keep it under like 22 and a half degrees centigrade. So
it's a painstaking process. It's a real labor of love in getting it to execution.
Yeah. Yeah. But so, you know, so I left Italy thinking, I love pinza. I love the shapes of the pizza. You know, maybe I'll come back to the United States and open a pizzeria. Then I hit myself over the head with a hammer and said, no, I'm not going to open a restaurant. And just shelved it for a while. And, you know, here we are now for the last year having a hard time going out to restaurants and, you know, getting carry out and making do at home, eating most of our meals at home. And I started really thinking that the pinza, because what I didn't tell you about is that once you make the dough and you let it rise at 72 hours, the crusts are then formed and partially baked in the morning. Then in the evening, afternoon, whenever you order it, the toppings are put on, it's put in the oven, and it's finished baking. So I'm thinking to myself, why can't this second bake be done in my kitchen? And, you know, get the same quality or the same exciting product in my house that I had in Italy. So that's really what kind of drove me to get this started, is that I really wanted to have something that we could cook at home that would be really good and really memorable.
Okay, you're at only because we only have a couple minutes left. So you're at your new kitchen, you're creating the product. What is the product that is now available?
Okay, so now what it is we've created the dough, we've created the crust, we've created the toppings, we are freezing it. And then it's designed to be baked in your oven at home. It takes 18 minutes and bam, it's just like you're sitting on a hillside in Italy, kind of. But so that's the thing. Right now we are selling it online on our website. Our goal with Union Kitchen, because they're big into developing consumer product goods, is to get it into supermarkets. But that's going to, you know, that's going to take some time. We'll be in the Union Kitchen stores starting next month. So distribution is beginning. So, you know, smaller gourmet stores are welcome to contact us if they wanted to check it out. And then lastly, we're starting to work with some restaurants that are looking to try to expand their offering through Uber Eats or the third party delivery services, because it could be delivered at the moment. And honestly, you know, if you order a pinsa online and you turn your oven on, by the time it gets to you and it's cooked, it's probably about the same time as ordering one of the big chains pizza, and it's pretty different. So
now, what kind of toppings are on the pinsas that you can order?
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask.
Okay, so our classic is San Marzano tomatoes, ricotta, and mozzarella. Really basic. We also make a dough that is called carbone, which has activated charcoal and grains in it with the same topping, which is really good. Our next bestseller is the classic called the Forest dough, which has truffled mushrooms and sausage that we make ourselves. We have a kind of an ode to Tuscany with a Sicilian pistachio that has mortadella, pistachio pesto, and cheese. So we have a couple of, we have some cool varieties online. Those won't be in the supermarket. Those will only be available online.
Well, so if we order, well, let me jump in, because if we order online now, if I order it at this moment, how long does it take for it to get to me, and how does it come so that it's still frozen and all of that?
So it's only local delivery now, and it's typically the next day, even the same day if you get to us before noon. Mm-hmm. And that's just because we're able to handle that volume ourselves at this point. So, so it might be me delivering it, and, you know, you don't have to tip me, so.
Excellent. Well, I think, you know, there needs to be a little education on the pinsa, because when David started the show, he was like, it's pizza. And I was like, no, it's pinsa. So, you know, getting people to understand the quality of the product and what it actually is really going to be on you to explain, since, you know, you're the first person I've met to tell us about it.
For sure. Well, I always like to say pinsa is pizza, but pizza isn't pinsa.
I love
it. So it's a type of pinsa that's just super thick, super light, super airy. And there's a lot of health studies showing that this long fermentation gets rid of a lot of the carbs. You know, it's possible that it lowers the glycemic index. You don't feel heavy. It's very, like in Italy, I don't know if you guys heard when you were in Italy, but everybody would always talk about digestibility. We only talk about digestibility to our doctors in the United States. They talk about it at dinner. And it's true. It is.
Jordan, I'm going to have to cut you off because the show is over. So do you mind just telling everybody your website or your Instagram page where they can order from you?
Sure. It's www.pinsa.love, no.com, just pinsa.love. And we're at pinsa.love on Instagram.
All right, Jordan, stay on the line because I want to talk to you after the show.
Okay. This is David and Nikki Nellis, Foodie and the Beast. We want to thank you so much for joining us today. Please remember, go to the list, areyouonit.com. We have lists of everything happening for inauguration, so many places to order from. Please support your restaurants. If you want them to be here after this pandemic, then you need to order from them. Do takeaway, tell your neighbors, get them all together, buy gift cards. Do what you can to hashtag save our restaurants. Lastly, mask up, dip your bod in hand sanitizer. Be safe, and we'll see you next week.
If you want to make an entrance, bring the sabor with new Modelo Chelada Fresa Picante. A mouth-watering mix of authentic Mexican beer, bold strawberry flavor, and a hint of spice. With great taste bursting out of every can. So bring something sweet to your next barbecue or bring a little spice to Sunday's brunch. Bring refreshing strawberry flavor to any fiesta with new Modelo Chelada Fresa Picante. Bring the sabor. Drink responsibly. Modelo Chelada flavored beers. Imported by Crown Imports, Chicago, Illinois.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.